Welcome to the Loop Neurotech Podcast. This is Doug Clinton. My guest today is Dr. Casey Means. Dr. Means is a Stanford-trained physician and the chief medical officer and co-founder of metabolic health company Levels, a Loop Ventures portfolio company. Dr. Means is also associate editor of the International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention. On this episode, we talk about the connection between glucose levels and brain health, and even some of the ties between glucose and Parkinson's disease. I thought it was a fascinating episode, a great introduction to the connection between the brain and metabolic health. So here is Dr. Casey Means. Casey, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Doug. So great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk, first of all, because we are investors in Levels, full disclosure to everyone listening, proud investors. I have also been a user of the product, and that's been very fun to see what my glucose levels do and how it affects just my physical health and my mental health. And so to start, Casey, I'd love if you could describe for everyone, number one, just what Levels does, and then what you do at Levels.
So my name is Casey Means. I am a medical doctor. I am a co-founder and chief medical officer of Levels. I'm also a functional medicine physician. I have a focused practice on metabolic optimization and longevity. I'm an editor of the International Journal of Disease Reversal and Prevention. And my work at Levels is really focused on helping us understand how to shape the product to really get as many benefits as we possibly can for our customers based on what we know about the research between glucose fluctuations and all aspects of mental and physical performance. I'll give a brief description of Levels. So you can think of Levels as sort of like a Fitbit for glucose. There are wearable sensors called continuous glucose monitors. And these are little sensors that are about the size of a quarter, and they stick to your arm. And it's a wearable sensor that measures glucose in your interstitial fluid, so the fluid between cells, 24 hours a day. And it sends that information right to your phone. And our Levels software transmits that data into highly actionable insights that lead you towards dietary and lifestyle choices that maximize stability of glucose levels. And we know that maximal stability of glucose levels is good for current wellness, good for prevention of future disease, and good for optimal mental performance. To kind of make this more concrete, you can imagine that you sit down at the dinner table and you're kind of like, I think I'm eating something healthy, but it's really hard to know what's exactly healthy for you. You know, there's a million dietary ideologies out there. There's a lot of conflicting nutrition information. And you sit down and you think you're doing a good job, but you really have no idea how that food is going to be affecting you, other than maybe how you feel a few hours, you know, down the road. But really, nutrition is very much like an open loop system. You don't have great data about how individual things that you're eating are affecting your health or your subjective experience. And there's a lot of variables involved. So what's really nice about Levels and continuous glucose monitoring is that it completely closes the loop between dietary and lifestyle choices and an immediate reaction. Glucose levels in the blood change within a half hour of when you eat something. So you can sit down, put something in your mouth, and know instantly, is this healthy for me or not? And what's also neat is that, you know, I think a lot of us have that experience where we eat a big meal and maybe an hour or two later, we're either like super fatigued. We have that post-meal slump. We need that little afternoon nap after lunch, or you kind of get a little brain fog, or maybe have a little afternoon anxiety or something. And to be able to scan your arm and say, oh, I had a huge glucose spike, and then I had a big insulin surge, and my glucose crashed, and I had, you know, this reactive dip in my glucose, and that's exactly when I had these symptoms. All of a sudden, there's all this new sort of granularity, and again, that closed loop to what's happening. It's no longer a mystery. And then you can quickly refine your diet and other choices to really kind of eliminate that glucose fluctuation and finally have an answer to why is this happening and how can I fix it? So we're all about shortening that distance between an action that you make and knowing sort of the reaction to that, because that closed loop really is fundamental to effective, sustainable behavior change.
For me, when I use the product, I found myself in some ways almost addicted to checking my levels. I was just curious all the time, maybe number one, because it was new, but number two, because I just wanted to know when I had eaten something, is this something that is affecting my glucose in potentially a negative way that I never really realized before? And how could I tailor my diet a little bit to try to avoid those really severe spikes? And like, you know, oatmeal for me wasn't too crazy. I know for some people, maybe that does spike their glucose. White rice was something that did really spike my glucose, maybe not too surprising, but just having the actual data was really enlightening. And we'll link to the show notes for anybody who does want to get that data. But I think it's super helpful just to be knowledgeable about how your body reacts to those foods.
Did you make any big changes? Did you start modulating the rice at all or any new additions to that? I'd be curious to hear.
So for the rice, I started to eat just much smaller portions of it. I do try to eat some carbs for athletic performance reasons. So I do some pretty intense training in strongman. And so I find I'd perform better when I do have some carbs in my system. But I do think that sometimes I probably overeat carbs. It's so easy to overeat white rice or even oatmeal when you just put it into a shake. So I find that I think I'm much more measured in actually how much I consume. And sometimes I try just not to eat it with a meal where maybe I normally would have it. I would maybe swap it for a vegetable or sweet potato or something like that.
Yeah, and that's interesting to hear about your experience with oatmeal and rice, because we have had so many Levels members who have had just these gigantic responses to oatmeal. And oatmeal is such a funny one because it is pretty much universally marketed as like a heart healthy food. It's like the healthy breakfast. And what we're seeing from so many of our customers is that just plain oatmeal, or, you know, some people might even add fruit or brown sugar or something to their oatmeal, can spike a lot of our customers into these diabetic levels of blood glucose. And often people were having sort of like the late morning, maybe slump, and now can really see that this is so much related to that glucose curve. Our CEO, Sam Korkos, this was really one of his early magic moments. And it kind of highlights, you know, you didn't have as much of a response. And that sort of highlights something really interesting about glucose control. We've learned over the past few years that people actually respond completely differently to the same foods. And there's really tons of biochemical individuality between how two people will respond to the same carb source. And a lot of this has come out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel and Michael Snyder's lab at Stanford, defining what are called like glucotypes, different types of people and how they respond to glucose. And so basically you give people, two people, the exact same food, non-diabetic individuals, let's say a cup of beans or oatmeal, and one person might go up to like 90 milligrams per deciliter of glucose, a low response, and one person might go up to 180. So that would be a good choice for the first person, but not the second person. And there's a lot of factors that go into why people respond differently. One of them that was a significant predictor in these studies was microbiome composition. So how the bacteria are interacting with that carbohydrate source, how that's releasing carbohydrates into the bloodstream was a big predictor, and other things like body type and how much recent exercise people did. So this traditional concept that a lot of us focused on of the glycemic index, which is sort of how much a particular 50 grams of a particular carbohydrate raises the blood in sort of an average person, and that being sort of a standard metric, actually we're realizing is not accurate, because it's much more likely that there's actually a glycemic index sort of for each person, for each food. And then what's more, when you pair foods together or put foods in different contexts, that's also going to change the personal glycemic index of the food. So, you know, if you take rice, we know that adding a protein or a fat source to a carbohydrate source is going to lower the glucose spike for most people. We also know that sequencing of meals, so eating carbohydrates second in the meal and eating other macronutrients before the carb source, is going to lower glucose spikes. We know that eating earlier in the day, the exact same meal versus later in the day, earlier will usually have less of a glucose response. If you're exercising, you're going to likely blunt glucose response. So there's all these different things that you can do to create a context for which that glycemic index for you is going to be different. You know, adding cinnamon, adding vinegar, these are insulin sensitizers. So it's really interesting. And this is what the research shows, but then how do you actually implement that into your everyday life? And that's sort of the next phase of nutrition, I think, is really personalizing it to your own unique biochemical blueprint.
For us at Loop Ventures, we have used the term performance health a lot to describe this potential, you know, opportunity, this emerging area and levels I think we put squarely into this performance health category. And one side of performance, obviously, is the physical side. And I think when we think about glucose levels and tweaking our diet, the first thing that comes to mind is physical performance and weight loss, perhaps. But the other side of glucose, which I wasn't really that aware of until we had started talking about more recently, was that there's also a big impact on mental function. And obviously, since this is a podcast about neuroscience and technology, I think that's a natural direction to go for us. And so how does a person's glucose levels affect the way their brain functions?
There's kind of two pieces to this. There's sort of the biologic mechanisms of it, and then there's kind of what we see epidemiologically. So we know that full-fledged metabolic dysfunction, so disorders of glucose dysregulation like type 2 diabetes, these diseases are associated with a whole host of neurodegenerative and cognitive disorders. So people with type 2 diabetes have significantly increased rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's disease is now kind of being called type 3 diabetes. And the thought is that insulin resistance, which is sort of the physiologic process by which blood sugar dysregulation develops, that insulin resistance in the brain means that these cells in the brain can't get glucose in. And so they are not processing energy properly. And the brain is such a glucose user that when it doesn't use glucose effectively, like in states of metabolic dysfunction, neurodegeneration occurs. So we know that in people with diabetes, high rates of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, additionally, twice the rates of anxiety and depression. So both mood and cognitive performance, big associations. There's also a much higher risk of hemorrhagic and ischemic stroke in people with diabetes. So like blood clots and bleeds in the brain. So the brain is really intimately involved in a lot of this stuff. But we also find that in people without diabetes, so people technically with normal, not meeting criteria for these disorders of metabolism, you know, going to the doctor yearly and actually having a normal fasting glucose level, people in that range, which maybe a lot of people listening to this podcast, fluctuations in glucose throughout the day, so just the up and down swings after meals, can actually have a big impact on our brain function, our dynamic brain function day to day. And this makes total sense because, as I said, you know, the brain runs on glucose. So any severe fluctuation, even if there's not, you know, a big problem with insulin resistance or diabetes, can still very much affect this sensitive organ. So the things that we're going to really be thinking about for the non-diabetic individual and trying to really tighten up those glucose spikes and dips is how can we make things with the glucose more stable to improve energy, to improve mood, and to improve mental clarity and reduce brain fog. And there is quite a bit of research with each of those categories, energy, mental clarity, and mood, that suggests that even if you're otherwise healthy, even if your fasting glucose is normal and your doctor's telling you you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, that getting the big swings in glucose throughout the day more tight can actually improve all three of those things. So, you know, happy to go into more of the research on that, but it's pretty exciting to think about because this is this really actionable thing. I mean, it's not difficult to tighten up your glucose if you know what to eat and you know how to eat properly with a product like a continuous glucose monitor. And to think that these things that we care a lot about, like mental sharpness, mood, and energy, are actionable, I think it's an exciting new era where CGMs, these devices, may actually become a mental performance tool, sort of in your toolbox of like meditation or mindfulness or things like that.
You mentioned that the brain is a major user of glucose. It's its main energy source. And I'm curious, how does that align with the trend to low-carb diets? So when you think about glucose from a physical standpoint, usually I think it's naturally we think, okay, well, we should eat less sugar, or we should eat less carbs. But if the brain needs glucose to function, does a low-carb diet actually have potentially a negative impact on cognitive performance, or like a keto diet or something like that, where, you know, we're really restricting carbohydrates?
So first of all, an important thing to note with the keto diet question is that when the body becomes really efficient at burning fat for energy, which is what you start seeing with people on the keto diet, the body makes ketones from fat oxidation, and the brain can actually also use ketones for energy. So that is an alternative fuel source for the brain in states of lower glucose availability. And so big picture, when we think about metabolism is essentially the set of all the sort of cellular mechanisms that generate energy from our food and our environment in order to power all the cells in our body. And the main sources of energy that we use to break down to make that cellular energy is glucose and fat. What's interesting is that you can't do both well at the same time. And the reason for that is because when there's a lot of glucose in the bloodstream, and we as Americans have a lot of glucose in our bloodstreams at all times because we're eating 10 times more refined sugar than we were 100 years ago, at least. So we've always got this glucose in the bloodstream. And when you have extra glucose in the bloodstream, what happens is that your body says, oh, we've got to get this out of the blood and we need to get into the cells so that we can use it or store it. And so it tells the pancreas to release insulin. And insulin's the hormone that is released into the bloodstream, binds to all the little cell membranes, and lets the cells take up glucose. So it can either be processed into energy or stored as stored glucose or turned into fat. So when that insulin is in the bloodstream and floating around, it is also an inhibitor of fat oxidation. So it tells the body, there's lots of glucose around, you don't need to burn fat. So this is why on a low carb diet, you need to restrict the carbs to be able to get into ketosis, because ketosis is the body being able to burn fat, and that has to happen in a low insulin state. What we're finding is that people who are able to sort of flip back and forth between burning glucose for energy when glucose is available or burning fat for energy when there's not a lot of glucose available, that's a state that we call metabolic flexibility. And really, dynamicism and flexibility in any living system is a good thing. We want things to be flexible. And right now, the average person walking around in the US is not metabolically flexible. And the reason is because we've been told for the last 20, 30 years that fat is bad. That was the 90s, you know, low fat everything. And so people were turning to a lot of refined carbohydrates and packaged foods. And we were also told that, you know, you should eat six meals a day to keep the metabolism revved up. And so what you get is you've got people basically stimulating their bodies with carb sources many, many times a day throughout all waking hours. We're also a culture that eats late at night. There's not a big fasting culture. And so what does that mean for the body? It means little spikes of glucose all the time, little spikes of insulin or big spikes of insulin all the time, and blocking that fat oxidation process. And so we just never really work the muscle of learning how to burn fat because we've always got insulin on board that's like essentially blocking fat oxidation. And this also feeds into our obesity and diabetes epidemic, because when your insulin is high, you're not able to burn that fat, which means you're keeping that weight on. This then kind of gets into the spectrum of what's called insulin resistance, which is the path towards diabetes in the body and the brain. And insulin resistance in the brain is very much linked to the things I was talking about, you know, the predisposition for neurodegenerative disease, et cetera. So what happens when your insulin is constantly sort of high is your cells see it all the time and they go, oh, there's so much insulin around. Like, we need to sort of like pause here. There's too much. So they sort of block the insulin from being able to signal effectively. And that's called insulin resistance. And so then the body pumps out more insulin because it's still seeing all this glucose in the blood. So now you get rising levels of insulin, insulin resistance in the body. And now glucose levels start to rise because it's essentially harder for it to get into the cells. And that's when you start seeing, you know, on the lab tests year to year that people get their finger pricked by their doctor and their fasting glucose is starting to rise because they're moving down this spectrum of insulin resistance. So this is all to say, coming back to the brain, that what's happening in the body is also happening in the brain. So as people are kind of moving down that spectrum, they stop being able to utilize the glucose and get the glucose into the brain cells as easily. So that's kind of a problem. And we want people to be able to be sort of metabolically flexible in the body and the brain so that when glucose is around, the brain cells can use it. But when, you know, you're fasting or doing a keto week or something or carb cycling, that you've also used that fat oxidation pathways effectively enough that you can get into a low insulin state and the brain can use ketones. ones when those are available. So for someone who's metabolically flexible, or another word to say that is fat adapted, when they're on a low carb diet, they're going to be able to use those ketones and do just fine. But for someone who may have never done ketosis, you know, and they don't have those pathways active, if they just go on a low carb diet day one and just stop eating any carbs, they're probably going to feel really fatigued and crappy because they're not producing ketones well yet. So we really like to think of this whole thing as a concept of metabolic fitness, where you have to actually work these pathways to get better at doing these things. But yeah, ultimately, the keto diet, like, the brain can use ketones, and that's great, but a lot of us aren't great at producing them right off the bat. And so we kind of need to work those pathways. That makes sense.
That was a beautiful description of how we can very easily go from just constantly having a little bit of glucose in our system all the time, which so many of us do, to insulin resistance, to, you know, diabetes, and then worst case, neurodegenerative issue. I love this term of a sort of metabolic flexibility. And I'd like to tie that to diet. So, like, when you get questions from people, you know, maybe they monitor their glucose a little bit and they see some things that are affecting them. What do you tell people to do with their diets? Like, what is the optimal diet if you want to sort of maximize both your physical and mental performance, in your opinion?
Well, I would say that the key to this is that there is no optimal diet. There is no universal optimal diet. There is optimal diets for the individual, but not for all people, because we are all totally unique, and digestion and metabolism are so, so complex. You know, it starts in the mouth with how your enzymes are breaking down food, but then it goes, you know, it's how fast your gut motility is. It's how your GI cell integrity, the lining of your GI tract is. It's your microbiome. It's your hormonal response in the body. It's how your cell receptors are responding to those hormones. It's mitochondrial function. It's how many mitochondrial cofactors do you have? It's so complex. And so there's just not a one size fits all. And that makes sense. You know, we know that because when you look out at our population, we've been pushing this sort of food pyramid, or there's these, like, you know, dietary ideologies. And yet what we're seeing is that 80% of consumers are confused about nutrition advice. 74% of Americans are overweight or obese, and 128 million Americans have diabetes or prediabetes. So clearly this sort of universal diet thing doesn't work. We really need to be focusing on our body's individual response. So that's where biofeedback and these sort of very tech-enabled diets can, you know, really, really help us optimize our bodies. But ultimately, there are some principles that you can focus on based on what we know about the research to help move you in the right direction. And so some bigger tier principles of things that, like, are going to probably be helpful for everyone. One is that we really don't need refined sugar in the diet. We're eating on average about 150 pounds of refined sugar per person per year. And our body doesn't need a single gram of that. You know, sugar from natural foods and the whole food forms, like, that's fine. Those are relatively a drop in the bucket compared to what you're going to get in a Clif bar that has 21 grams of refined sugar, or a soda, which has, you know, 50 grams of refined sugar. Sure, these days, because we may be on the insulin resistant spectrum, you can eat an apple and have a huge glucose spike because we've been just bombarding our bodies with these toxic refined sugars that are causing us to not respond to any sugar properly. But a well-functioning, healthy body is going to be able to process complex, natural, whole food carbohydrates very, very well generally. But I would say the biggest issue in terms of universal diets is get the refined stuff out of it. The same is true of refined carbohydrates in general. So we know that as you refine a carbohydrate source more and more, it's going to usually have more of a glycemic response in the body. And these are population statistics. So for the individual, it might be different. But if you take a whole grain and just eat, like, a wheat kernel compared to processing it into sort of a coarse milled flour versus a refined flour versus an ultra refined white bleached flour, the glucose response is going to go up generally as you move to the more refined version of that. So big picture, getting the refined stuff out of the diet is probably going to be good for everyone. It really comes down to our bodies evolve to respond to food with a lot of signals. So you eat food and then the body responds by releasing tons of hormones that tell you, you know, either eat more, you need more energy, or you're satiated, that was enough food. And when you feed it refined stuff, those signals kind of gets hijacked. Your body doesn't know how to respond to this processed glucose, this processed carbs, and processed grains. And so a lot of those feedback mechanisms from the body get hijacked. So the more we can eat whole foods, I think the better off we are. But in terms of what particular foods are going to be best for a person's glycemic response amongst healthy whole foods, you know, like a white potato, a sweet potato, rice, fruits, like those things you really actually need to test out for the individual, because what might not spike me might give someone else a huge spike based on their microbiome and their body type and this and that. So
that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think that ties, you know, right into this idea of performance health, where everybody performs differently. Everybody's body is constructed in a different way and responds to things differently. And so understanding the individual, I think, is just so important for diets of the future, to your point. I mean, universal diets has been sort of the trend for maybe the past 100 or so years as we've thought about nutrition. And we've tried to do these one size fits all type recommendations, and they don't work well. They can work temporarily, but I think when we figure out how an individual really responds and you can tailor specifically for them what is best, I think that makes such a huge difference. And that's really what Levels is all about.
Exactly. We really are trying to help people build out their whole set of tools that they can use to modulate glycemic responses. Fundamentally, this is not supposed to be restrictive. This is not about eliminating things. This is about building the context in the body to be able to process carbohydrates effectively. A lot of people think like, oh, I'm going to put this glucose monitor on and I'm not going to be able to eat my favorite foods anymore because they're going to spike my glucose. But that's actually really different from what happens. Instead, what you realize is that you can modulate the food to make it work better for you. And so I mentioned a few things already, like adding fat and protein, sequencing the meals appropriately. But we also know that the variables that feed into what the glycemic output is, the main drivers are actually your stress levels, how much sleep you got, how much exercise you did, then of course the food. And so you have a lot of these different levers to pull. If you are high stress and your stress hormones are very active, this is actually going to cause your body to think you're in a state of stress, and it's going to mobilize more glucose, and it's going to make you sort of transiently a little bit insulin resistant, because your body is going to think that even if it's just you got a stressful email, your body's going to register that as there's a threat here and I need to mobilize my energy sources to fight that threat. So if we're constantly in a stress state, we're probably going to respond higher with our glucose levels to any food that we eat. If we've gotten less sleep, we're going to have a higher glucose response. There's been some really interesting studies showing that if you take healthy groups of individuals and deprive them of sleep for 4 or 5 days, and not fully deprive them of sleep, just have them get 4 hours of sleep instead of 8 hours of sleep a night, you can essentially send normal people into pre-diabetic levels for their glucose. That lack of sleep is going to totally change physiology. Again, it's going to release a lot of stress hormones. That's not a natural state for the body. With exercise, sedentary behavior is significantly associated with increased glucose responses, even in the short term. If you take people, they've done some studies, like you put someone and immobilize them for as little as 5 days, they are going to become acutely insulin resistant. So you can think like, let's say you break your leg and you're in the hospital for a few days, not moving around. That signals to your body that within 5 days, that lack of movement is going to essentially put you into a very insulin resistant state. And then of course, there's the food piece. So in food, there's the food combinations that we talked about, but there's also food timing. So like I mentioned, eating later in the evening is usually going to be less bang for your buck in terms of a glucose response. As we get later in the evening and the sun goes down, we release melatonin from our pineal gland. And melatonin is that hormone that helps us fall asleep, but it also tells the body that, you know, we probably don't need to process much energy right now. So it makes your body a little bit less responsive to insulin and actually makes the pancreas potentially not secrete as much insulin. This kind of feeds into why we see things like intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding being really positive for glucose control, and these sort of time-restricted feeding windows that are becoming really popular with apps like, you know, the Zero Fasting app and things like that. These are great for weight loss. They're great for improving glucose function. And, you know, it's because one, those times when you're not eating, your body has less exposure to insulin. And over time, as you keep your insulin levels lower, your cells become more insulin sensitive again, because, you know, that insulin resistance, that numbness because of this high level of insulin starts to melt away. And then you can start processing carbs potentially a little bit better. So there's all these levers to pull: exercise, sleep, stress management, food, food timing, food combinations. And so as opposed to being sort of this restrictive thing, this can really help people build these beautiful contexts for how to process food effectively. It's not just about the food. So in that way, glucose becomes this really centralizing nidus for a lot of these different lifestyle behaviors that a lot of us are really trying to improve in our lives. The glucose readout is a result of so many of these different important factors of diet and lifestyle. And so from a behavior change standpoint, it's very high yield to focus on glucose.
That's a great message, a hopeful message, I think, to end on, which is that as we think about the evolution of dieting, it's going to be an exercise in freedom rather than restriction in the future. And levels, I think, you know, I've loved using the product. I think everyone should try it. We'll link in the episode if anybody's interested. You know, I think Levels is one of the companies that's helping us get there. Casey, thanks for your work on building Levels. And thank you for joining us on the podcast today. It's been great.
I really appreciate that. And I love the note that you ended on of promoting freedom rather than restriction. That's something we think about a lot. And ultimately, our goal is to empower people with their data so that they can really improve the sense of their personal agency and autonomy over their lives and over their health, and to just give people the tools to take ownership and to improve. And so it really is about freedom and personal empowerment. And so I really love that. And we're so grateful for our relationship with Loop. And thank you so much for having us on the podcast.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, Casey.